So take your Bible, your smartphone, your tablet, find your way to Exodus chapter 14. Now, if this is your first time with us today, we're glad that you're here. We want to welcome you. If you need more information about the church, you can go out the back doors to my left. There's an information desk there and a lot of friendly, helpful people there that can answer the questions that you might have. The other thing that we would want you to know is that most Sunday mornings, if you attend here on a regular basis, you'll find that we are studying our way through whole books of the Bible, and currently we are studying our way through the Old Testament book of Exodus. Now, as Jim pointed out last week, one of the prayers that we have as we study this book is that we would continually see God doing Exodus in our lives today, that we would continually experience and witness His liberating love working on our behalf. And there is no more profound place in all of the book of Exodus to see those two things than in Exodus chapter 14. Exodus 14 is the great climactic point of the book of Exodus. It's the event that makes it onto all the movie posters, and it's right there on the top of your sermon note-taking page as well. It's the event where God delivers His people, Israel, once and for all, out of the slavery, their slavery in Egypt, as the Egyptians are swallowed up by the sea. Now, what we need to see most is how the Exodus story has become our story, especially as we read it through the lens of Jesus Christ, who's taken up the Exodus story in His own life and death and resurrection. Jesus transformed what we read here in Exodus 14. He expanded it and has even called us into it, because as Christians, God calls us to live out the story of Exodus. Not live out stories of enslavement and exile, but the stories of God, the story of the Exodus that God has come. He rescues us, He restores us, He sets us free from those our old past life and the ways of the world. He sets us free so that we can live free in the gospel. The Exodus story is the defining moment in the life of the Old Testament people of God. It's the great redemptive work by which they understood who they were and whose they were. And all through the rest of the Old Testament, we see poets and prophets looking back to this great event as a reminder that Yahweh is Israel's God and Israel is Yahweh's people. It's the story in which we see our salvation and understand our salvation, because you see, Exodus salvation is about God calling us out of one kind of life and into another. It's a story of life change, and that's what Old Testament and New Testament salvation is all about. So the question is this, that's what I want to look at this morning. What do we need to know from the Exodus story to continually see God doing Exodus in our lives today? What do we need to know from this story that in order to continually see and experience and witness God's liberating love in our lives in the same way that the Israelites experienced His liberating love in their lives? And I'm especially talking about those times when it seems like the odds are stacked against us, which seems to me is what God would have wanted the Israelites to take away from the shores of the Red Sea in the months and the years ahead, that they would look back and they would see who God is and what God has done and apply what they've experienced in the past to their present. So I want to look this morning at three basic takeaways from the Exodus story, and there are a lot of them because we could spend 3 or 4 or 5 weeks just on Exodus 14, but I'm going to pull out three things that we need to know because, and these come like right out of my journal. I mean, these are things that I have to always go back to. So these are things that are especially meaningful to me as I look at this, and so you're just going to get the overflow from me, all right? So these are three things that we need to know that will help us continually see God doing the Exodus in our lives as we live in His liberating love. But before we get to that, let me do a quick review. What's happened so far in the story? I'm guessing that most of you know this story from your church background. If you did not grow up in a church, then I'm guessing that you might have seen one or more of the three big movies on Exodus. There in the middle is probably the biggest one, Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston, big movie. Then there's The Prince of Egypt. It's an animated version. It's a musical, if you like that kind of thing. And then you got Exodus, Gods and Kings with Christian Bale, which when I watched it, I was reminded just how prone we are to not understand this story at all. All right, I guess you could have gotten it more wrong, but I don't see how. I mean, because it almost had no Bible in it whatsoever. But I got some things out of it, but yes. Now, how many of you have seen one or more of these movies? Raise your hand. Okay, most of you. So you know that God's people, Israel, were slaves of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and they had been slaves for over 400 years. 400 years. And this is so important because if you don't understand how oppressive and how much the Israelites suffered at the hands of the Egyptians in slavery, then the significance of this event doesn't really make much sense. But what you need to understand is when you're a slave, you are property. You are owned. You're told who you are. You're told what you can do. You're told where to go. You work all day in the burning hot sun. You come home exhausted. You eat just enough food to give you some strength. You go to sleep and you get back up the next day and you do the same thing over and over again. And that is your life, start to finish. If you're owned by the Egyptians, if they want to take the little that belongs to you, they will. If you're owned by the Egyptians, if they want to rape your wife, they will. If you're owned by the Egyptians, if they want to kill your children, they will. You have no rights. There's nothing you can do about it. No freedom. That's what the word slave means in Egypt. Sadly, it means meant the same thing in our country as well. To make a long story short, God hears the cries of his people, and he calls out and sends Moses, former prince of Egypt, turned murdering fugitive, turned desert goat herder. Okay? He calls Moses to deliver them. Moses is 80 years old at the time. So Moses, because he's 80, he goes down, gets in his Lincoln town car, and he drives all the way to Egypt with his blinker on. I'm going to get in trouble for that. But anyway, I'm going to be 62 on December the 8th, so I'm driving along my Jeep sometimes. I don't realize my blinker's on either, so I'm getting up there. But anyway, so Moses and Aaron go before Pharaoh, and they deliver God's message. They say, Yahweh, God of the Hebrews, commands you, let my people go so they can serve me. And Pharaoh says, now, while I was gone, y'all, how many of you saw the video update of the new building and everything that's going on? How many of you saw that video? All right, how many of you saw the pitiful attempts to impersonate the voice of Yoda? Okay, yeah, you did. All right, here you go. So Pharaoh says in his best Yoda voice,
Yahweh, I do not know. I will not let you go.
So
patience, young Padawan. So, anyway, then you get the ten.
No. Then, then you get the 10 plagues that we looked at, all of which were God's judgment, specifically targeting Egyptian gods. So you remember that, like the Egyptians worship Ra, the sun god. So in the 9th plague, what does God do? He blocks out the sun so that the darkness covers all the land of Egypt where the Egyptians live, but not the land of Goshen where the Israelites live. The Egyptians worship the frog god Hapi, and so what does Yahweh do? He sends a plague of frogs so that the frogs are everywhere, and the Egyptian priests, they pray to Hapi, and they beg Hapi to take the frogs away, but Hapi's not happy, and so nothing happens. The reason is because there's no God of Hapi. I mean, it's because Yahweh rules the frogs, not Hapi. And so it's all the plagues are directed against the Egyptian gods. If you don't believe me, Exodus 12:12 says specifically that God was waging war against the gods of Egypt. And then we come to the 10th plague, the final plague, which was the death of the firstborn sons and the firstborn of all the herds of Egypt. Now, why that plague? Because Pharaoh himself was considered a god. So this is a plague that's aimed directly at him. and against what he did in killing thousands and thousands of Hebrew children. Now, with the 10th plague, we finally come to the exit of Exodus, the exit of Exodus. Hard-hearted Pharaoh finally relents and lets Israel go. He says, get up, get out, and the Hebrew people, over a million of them, pack up and leave immediately. Now, it is true that there's much debate over the exact route that they took, but here's how I see it. So you see up there in the left-hand side, you see Goshen. That's where they lived. And so Exodus 13:20 says that they left Goshen and they went to Succoth. They're in the middle of the Sinai Peninsula on the west coast. You see Succoth. Now, if you're going to go from Egypt to Israel, the shortest route is to go along the coast of the Mediterranean Sea, the east coast of the Mediterranean Sea. And that's what Jim talked about last week, and so I won't go back into that, but they go the exact opposite direction. It says that they go to Succoth, and then they go all the way down to Migdol, which is at the point, and then they come up to Etham, and they camp there. Now, if you didn't know that God was leading them by a pillar of cloud at night and a pillar of fire by day, you would think that Moses was just a man who refused to stop and ask directions when he was lost. But God is leading him, so that brings us to chapter 14, verse 1. We're still in the journey phase. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi Hahiroth, between the mountains of Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Tzephon, and you shall encamp facing it by the sea. So again, here's they've come down. This is the Sinai Peninsula turned sideways. So they've come down from Succoth. They turn and go around the mountain ranges of Migdol. They go to Etham. And then he says, turn back south. So they come back this way. Turn back, and they camp there at Pi Hahiroth. And they're looking across the Red Sea to Baal Tzephon. All right, you see that? All right, so here it says now, here's the question. Why did God tell them to turn back? One simple reason. God is baiting Pharaoh, okay? He's baiting Pharaoh. He's not finished with Pharaoh yet. Look at verse 3. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they're wandering in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. He's going to say, they're not even going the right direction. They're going down the Sinai Peninsula. I mean, they're way down at the bottom of that thing, and they're just wandering around. Moses doesn't have any idea what he's doing. So, and then God says, here's what I'm going to do. I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all of his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And that's what Israel did. Now, question, does God know what he's doing? Yes. Do the people know what God is doing? No. Does Moses know what God is doing? Yeah. I mean, he just told Moses this is what he was going to do. He's going to pursue. He's going to have Pharaoh pursue, and he's going to harden Pharaoh's heart, and he's going to, whatever this means, he's going to get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. Okay? All right, verse 5. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed towards the people. And maybe they fled because they said they were going to go 3 days in the wilderness and now they haven't come back. That's what some people say. I don't know. But their mind changed. What is this we have done that we have let Israel go from serving us? So Pharaoh made ready his chariot and took his army with him and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with the officers over all of them. Now, by the way, when we read the word chariot, we do not have an emotional reaction to that word. But if you were a person living in the ancient Near East during this particular time, you would have a strong, fearful, emotional reaction because chariots were the most aggressive weapon in an army's arsenal because a soldier could travel very quickly in a chariot across flat terrain and maintain a fighting position. So, I mean, these were like the tanks of the ancient world. A chariot means power. Lots of chariots means lots of power, very intimidating. This is a massive army with enormous military might, but I want you to notice, this massive military force is being orchestrated by God's doing, not Pharaoh's. Very important. Verse 8. Look at verse 8. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh. Who's doing it? God. And he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out. Circle, highlight, underline. As the people were going out defiantly, boldly, the Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them and camped at the sea at Pi Hahiroth in front of Baal Zephon. And so here's another picture. This is the view Israel saw across the Red Sea where they camped for 8 days. So, you know, I thought this was kind of interesting that Israel actually had these beach tiki huts back then. I mean, you think we're the only ones that have these kind of resort kind of things. Well, here's Israel. They've got the, no. Anyway, but you can see how, all right, just think. Like off to the left, there's the mountains of Migdol, so they can't go, a million people can't go up there. You know, around the corner is on kind of on the right is going to be the Egyptian army, and their only hope is across the sea, which is only about a half a mile across, but when you can't get across a half mile water, you're kind of between a rock and a watery place. I mean, you're not getting across there. So, verse 10, when Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they went from bold defiance to fearing greatly. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. Now, I want to stop right here because I want us to look at what we read so far and tease out the first thing we need to know in order for us to continually see God doing Exodus in our life. Now, here's the question. Why are the Hebrew people in the place that they're in? Why are they where they are? Why? God put them there. God led them there. The pillars of cloud and fire, which represents the presence of God and the voice of God. Chapter 14, verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, tell the people to turn back. The pillars and the voice have led the people to this point right here. So here's my first point when you find yourself in a place where odds are stacked against you. Number one, know that God has put you where you are. Know that God has put you where you are. Know that God orchestrates the events of your life so that you're always where He wants you to be. Now, do you believe that? Yeah. Well, I know we say we believe it, but you know, do we really believe it? I mean, I think most of us struggle to believe it, just like the people inside the story here were struggling to believe it at this point. I mean, because there's danger behind them. There's no escape in front of them. They feel totally helpless and hopeless. And they're worried sick. Worried sick. How many of you are worriers? Raise your hand. How many of you are worriers? Okay. How many of you are liars? Okay. All right. Here's the deal. I like how the great preacher John R. Rice put it. Now, how many of you know who John R. Rice is? He is Libby Hanford's father. Okay, great preacher. All right, he said, here's how he puts it. He says, worry is putting question marks where God has put periods. Worry is putting question marks where God puts periods. Well, what does that mean? Well, did God promise to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt and take them to the land that He promised Abraham? Yes, yeah, it's a double promise. He promised Abraham 400 years earlier that he would bring them back to the land, and he promised Israel that they were going back to the land. So when God promises, that's a period at the end of the promise. There's a promise, there's a period at the end of God's promises. There are never any question marks. But as you know, and I know, it's not always that easy. Pastor Robert Morgan wrote a little book titled Red Sea Rules, The Red Sea Rules, which I read this week. And in it, he asked this. He says, how can you not worry? I had somebody come up to me after the service and say, I'm right here. How can you not worry when you have a commando son being secretly inserted into deadly situations around the globe? I mean, how can you not worry when your outflow exceeds your income and the creditors are calling? How can you not worry when your financial portfolio is collapsing? How can you not worry when your loved one is diagnosed with cancer? How can you not worry when your job is terminated, or your child is troubled, or your safety is at stake? Or to put it differently, he says, how can you not worry when the Red Sea faces you, the desert surrounds you, and the soldiers of Egypt are speeding toward you with drawn swords? I mean, it's tough, isn't it? In the story of the Red Sea, the Israelites follow the pillar of cloud and fire as carefully as possible, and they are thrilled with their new freedom, full of excitement about the future. Again, verse 8 says they're going out defiantly. They got an attitude. I mean, they're going out, our God is an awesome God. He reigns from heaven. Come on, boy. Come on, boy. I mean, man, we just showed Egypt, didn't we? I mean, I guess we showed them. I mean, it's like they've come from Sunday worship and they're all pumped. Or they've come back from winter chill or summer breeze or whatever. I don't know. And they're riding high on spiritual adrenaline. And they're like, dude, I'm living victorious here. I'm more than a conqueror. I'm not quite sure where God's taking me, but with God on my side, I'm good. I'm real good because our God just kicked Pharaoh rear end. And so, I mean, you've been in a spiritual high place like that where you feel invincible, and that'll last a couple hours. I mean, they're marching out with an attitude, last a couple hours. Because as soon as trouble strikes, what do? Well, they do pretty much what we do. I mean, they fall apart. They're terrified. They cry out to God for help. But this is not prayer. So any application to prayer here is just misguided. This is not prayer. This is not a prayer of faith. It's more like grumbling, complaining, blaming, cry of self-pity. Now, why do I say that? Because of what they say next, verse 11. And they said to Moses, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you, circle that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Have you, circle, what have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not what we said to you, circle, in Egypt? We told you to leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the desert. Like, what? No, they never said that. They never said that. I mean, look, you were slaves in Egypt. You had no rights, no freedoms, no fulfillment, no independence, no life, and you were completely shackled in slavery, and you're crying out to God. And what does he do? He comes and he does the plagues, and he devastates Egypt, and he breaks the will of Pharaoh, and you march out in boldness and in victory. And then Pharaoh changes his mind. Correction, God changes Pharaoh's mind. They don't know that, though. But God changes his mind, and he comes after you, and you're like, ah, oh, no, Moses, what have you done to us? We never wanted to leave Egypt. We just want the good old days. And they've forgotten that the good old days were not good. They're just old. I mean, man, this is crazy. This is delusional thinking. They are in denial. Not the Nile, but denial. I know, it's corny. I had to do that. I got to keep you with me somehow. So anyway, they've completely rewritten their history. I mean, something is missing here. What is missing? What is missing? I mean, you would think that they would say, well, we just seen the God of Moses work 10 devastating plagues on Egypt. We just seen Yahweh give this irrefutable, undeniable evidence of his power and his commitment to us. I mean, he's brought the most powerful nation on earth to its knees. And we're standing right in front of the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. You understand that? How big would the pillar of fire and a pillar cloud have to be for a million people to see it? I mean, we're talking huge. And they're standing right in front of it. And why aren't they saying, look, Yahweh is still with us. Yahweh is still with Moses. We need one more plague, an 11th plague. What say you, Moses? God did it before. He can do it again. But God isn't even in the equation. I mean, in all their complaining and blaming, there's no mention of God. In fact, complaining and grumbling feeds the fear, the anxiety, the blaming, the self-pity. Complaining and blaming do that, you understand. Complaining and blaming keeps them and keeps you and me from seeing God. Now, why is that? Now, why is this happening? Here it is. Because they're still slaves. not slaves of Pharaoh, but they're slaves to fear. They're slaves to their emotion, slaves to what they see and feel and hear. They're slaves of this delusional thinking that so often when we're afraid and can't make sense out of what's going on, it just turns over and over and over in our minds. They're slaves of circumstance instead of submitting to what they know to be true about God. Now, why is that the case? Two reasons. First, they are slaves because their focus is on their troubles rather than on Yahweh. Their focus is on their hot mess rather than who God is and what God has done for them. Now, listen, I don't have a lot of time to go into this in much detail, but I want to give you something huge here. And that is that you'll never get free of your lust by focusing on your lust. You'll never get free of your anger by focusing on your anger. You'll never get free of your depression and anxiety by focusing on your anxiety. You won't get free from your insecurities by focusing on your insecurities. You learn to grow through those things by focusing on God, on who God is and what God has done for you. You don't get out of Egypt by focusing on Egypt. You get out of Egypt by focusing on God. Now, the second reason they're still slaves is because they've lost sight of the obvious, and they don't know what's going to happen or what God's going to do, but they do know that God has led them to where they are because the pillar of cloud and fire is right there, and they've been following the manifest presence of God, and they know that Moses has heard God say, go this way, go that way, turn back. So God's put them in that place. And listen, this is an important place because in this place, looking across the Red Sea to Baal Zephon, this is going to be the nexus from where God gets glory, Israel experiences salvation, and Egypt is judged. These three things, they're all connected, and this is where it's going to happen. So here's the deal. When the odds seem stacked against you, know that God has put you where you are. He's orchestrated the events in your life so that you're always where He wants you to be. You got to know that. You won't experience exodus in your life unless you see that God has put you in a place, listen, that God has put you in a place where you have a front row seat to see how He's going to work. So important. So what does Moses tell them that they need to do as they spew out all of this fear and bitterness and blame on him? Now, this is interesting to me because Moses does the exact opposite of what I would do. I mean, notice this. Interestingly enough, he doesn't defend himself. He doesn't debate the ridiculous things they just said. He doesn't recount all the obvious things that they should know. He didn't go, well, don't you remember plague one and plague two and plague two? And how? He doesn't go through all that. He doesn't go through what they should know. He doesn't say, hush, don't you know the cloud can hear you? I mean, because they're complaining right there in front of the cloud. Moses doesn't tell them what God told him. In verse 4, God told Moses up front that he would harden Pharaoh's heart one final time, and Pharaoh would come after him, and something's going to happen where God's going to get glory over Pharaoh and his army. He doesn't say that. What does he say? He just tells them three things. He tells them three things. Moses said to the people, fear not, stand firm, see the salvation of your God, which he will work for you today. That's a promise. For the Egyptians whom you see back there in the distance, you see him back there, you will never see again, for the Lord your God will fight for you. You just need to shut up and watch it. That's what he says, literally. Now, Moses has to move quickly, and logic doesn't win over emotion, so he doesn't try to reason with these people. He just steps up and tells the people three things. Fear not, stand firm, see the salvation of the Lord. Don't be afraid, stand your ground, see what God's going to do. Now, how do they do that? By taking God at His word, by taking Him at His promise. What did He promise? He said, you're going to see it today. You're not going to ever see those Egyptians again because God will fight for you. Now, I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but here's what I'm picturing. I'm picturing this mass of a million people, and as soon as they look back and they see Pharaoh and his army and the dust coming down the road, I'm seeing them break up camp, and they're getting ready to run away. I don't know where, just anywhere, but where they are. And where are they? They're in the place that God put them so they could have front row seats to see his salvation. Fear not, stand firm, see the salvation of the Lord. Three things that boil down to one thing. What is the one thing? Wait. Wait for God to work. Leave room for God to work. It's not over yet. The second thing we need to know in order to continually experience Exodus in our lives is that we need to know that waiting for God to work is very often the place from which you see God's salvation. It's in the place of waiting that we see God's salvation. And to wait, you need what? You need faith. The place of waiting is the place you learn to trust God for things you don't yet see. Waiting is an act of faith. You say, waiting is an act of faith. I mean, yeah, I thought faith was active. It is. It will be in just a moment. God will tell Israel to move forward straight into the sea, which doesn't make any sense. Just wait and see. Wait for God to work. Stop being afraid. Stand firm. See your salvation. Wait. But I don't know about you, but, well, how many of you just detest waiting? Okay. All right. Yeah. I mean, I detest waiting in traffic. I don't like waiting in line at Walmart. I don't like waiting if there's a chance that I'm going to be late. If somebody is going to make me late, you understand what I'm saying, right? Just don't want this to be on the tape or on the recording. Anyway, I don't like waiting an hour past an appointment time where the schedule was set. I don't like waiting to see if God's going to change somebody's heart. I don't like waiting for a relationship to change, especially if I don't know it is going to change. And I especially don't like someone telling me good things come to those who wait. But for a Christian, waiting is an act of faith, and it's a faith builder. How is it a faith builder? Because when you wait on God, you live in tension. In the tension between trusting God and trusting yourself. As you wait, every time you make a choice to trust God over self, your faith pleases God, honors God, glorifies God, and your faith grows stronger. Because you see, here it is. Faith is applying God's promises to your predicament. It's applying God's promises to your problems. Faith replaces question marks with periods. Now, do you realize that simply waiting on God is an incredible success? I'm talking about times when the circumstances are way beyond your control. There's absolutely nothing you can do to change them. In times like that, simply waiting on God is an incredible success, because the fact is, sometimes we try to run ahead of God. Sometimes, and this is our natural tendency, we take things into our own hand when things don't happen as quickly as we want them to. Sometimes we want to go back to Egypt, to an old life, to an old sin, to an old addiction, to an old unhealthy relationship, an old form of slavery. And if we're honest, sometimes we just want to give up. Listen, waiting on God to work, leaving room for God to work, is an incredible act of faith. And that in and of itself is a success, because waiting in faith is a way that we glorify God. We make much of him because we're saying he's worth waiting on. And it's a way that we make much of God. Very often when we're faced with what seems to be impossible odds, the only way that you're going to experience Exodus in your life is to wait. And again, the place of waiting is a front row seat in which you see God's salvation break into your life. The place where you learn to trust God for things you do not yet see. Now, what are you waiting for? Well, you're waiting for God to tell you what to do next. And what comes next is what, I mean, it's just amazing, incredible. It's life-changing. I mean, it's like, there's no word to describe it. Verse 15. The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward into the sea, I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Just watch. Now, look at this. He says, Moses, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. Now, I don't have time to go in this today, but I'm going to come back to this because I think this is absolutely incredible because God told Moses to divide the sea. You say, what? Look at me, I'm holding my hands up. Look, I'm looking at you. He's holding his hands up, the sea is going to part. I mean, this is incredible. Stay with me. All right, here we go. So he says, you hold out your hands, divide, and the sea will divide that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they shall go in after you, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts, his chariots and his horsemen. The Egyptians then will know that I'm the Lord. I will get my glory when I have gotten my glory over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. Now he says. Now what he says is, I'm going to give you a head start. Okay, verse 19. Then the angel of God who was going before the host of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. There was a cloud and the darkness. There was the cloud and the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. So this is happening at night. Did you know that? Exodus happens at night. So here's what it's saying. Pharaoh's army is completely in the dark. Israel is in the light on this night. And by the way, what was the ninth plague? Darkness. What was the tenth plague? Death. It's deja vu all over again. They should have known before death comes darkness, after death comes darkness. Verse 21, Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back. So there's this cooperation between Moses and God. It blows my mind that God would use us to do mighty things like this. It's God that drives back the sea with a strong east wind all night, and it made the sea dry ground, and the waters were divided. And the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall on their right hand and a wall on their left hand. You think that would be a little scary? I mean, absolutely. The Egyptians pursued them and went in after them into the midst of the sea, all of Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and horsemen. And in the morning watch, in other words, just before the sun came up, the Lord in the pillar of fire and cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces. Now look what happens. And he threw the Egyptian forces into panic, clogging their chariot wheels so much so that they drove their horses heavily. I mean, they were really riding on those horses. Now, what was the symbol of Egypt's great power? Chariots. And what does God do? He clogs up the wheels of their power. And I take it that this had to be more than just they got stuck in the mud. Two reasons. One, Israel went across on dry ground, and I've seen some of the movies where the water starts to trickle back, you know, when they're coming and they get sick in the mud. Maybe so. But here, look at what the Egyptian chariot drivers concluded by what was happening with their chariot wheels. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against us. What did God promise? Verse 14, God promised he would fight for them. What did he do? He is fighting for them so much so that the enemies of God know that the Lord is winning the battle. The Lord is fighting them. The Lord fights for Israel. This is his promise, period. Faith replaces question marks with periods. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch your hand over the sea again, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and horsemen. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the seas returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. So when the sun came up, God wants Israel to see what he's done in judging the Egyptian army. So morning appeared, and as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the host of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked across on dry ground, the waters being a wall on the right and on their left. So, verse 30, the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. This is Israel's salvation through Egypt's judgment, and it brings what? Glory to God. Verse 31, Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So God was glorified. People feared, awe and reverence of the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses for a couple of hours. So the summary so far, to see God, when it comes, when you're in a situation where the odds are stacked against you, know that God has put you where you are. And know that waiting for God to work is very often the place where you have a front row seat to see God doing things for you that you cannot do for yourself. Now, here's the third thing you need to know to continually experience Exodus in your life. Number three, know that God does not deliver you to desert you. God does not deliver you only to desert you. He does not save you to abandon you. And this is huge. This is going to be the lesson that Israel will need going forward. They will have to learn this over and over again. And as the story of the Exodus moves from the Red Sea to Mount Sinai and all the way into the Promised Land, what they need to know and learn and look back on is this lesson, that God does not save to forsake. He does not deliver to desert them. But here's the deal. Knowing these things is not enough. You don't just learn it one time and then you got it. These are life lessons that we have to keep learning. So knowing these things is not enough because why? Because it's so easy to forget them when the reality of something hitting us, this reality of something tangible that we see and hear and touch and feel, that tempts us to fear, tempts us to run away or go back to an old pattern of life. When those things come crashing in, those things seem more real than the invisible God. So what do we need to do? Here's the big idea. To continually see God doing Exodus in your life, you have to continually remind yourself of what you know to be true. You don't learn this lesson once. You have to continually remind yourself of what you know to be true. In order to experience and witness God's liberating love and salvation and work on your behalf, you got to remind yourself of things that you know to be true. I was in a coffee shop when I came across a page from his journal. I don't know exactly what was going on in this man's life, but I knew it had to be bad. It had to be real bad. I know he was a God-fearing man because from what he wrote, he had prayed and cried out to God for God to intervene in his difficult circumstances, but God was silent. He could find no comfort. He could find no relief. It seemed to me, as I read it, that he was going through what the ancients called the dark night of the soul, time when God wasn't very real to him. He questions God's faithfulness and love for him. He's afraid. He's exhausted from a lack of sleep, uncertain, frustrated, so troubled he could barely put his anguish into words. Have you been in a place like that? Maybe you're in a place like that now. I mean, what do you fear so much that it paralyzes you from being able to move forward in faith? I mean, what are the circumstances that seem so overwhelming to you that makes it incredibly difficult to trust that God will take care of you, that God will provide for you, that God will make a way for you? Or maybe God's calling you to do something that just seems so impossible. It actually seems so unrealistic, but you know he's pressing on you, and you're losing sleep over that because you just don't know how in the world this is all going to come to pass. I mean, when you get stuck in a time when the odds seem stacked against you, what do you do with all that? Well, here's what he did. Let me read what he wrote in his journal. By the way, this comes from Psalm 77. It's by a man named Asaph. He says, I cry out to God. Yes, I shout to God. Oh, that God would listen to me. When I was in deep trouble, I searched for the Lord. All night long I prayed with hands lifted toward heaven, but my soul was not comforted. I think of God and I moan. I am overwhelmed with longing for his help. God, you don't let me sleep. I'm too distressed even to pray. I think of the good old days long since ended when my nights were filled with writing joyful songs. I search my soul and I ponder the difference between then and now. I mean, has the Lord rejected me forever? Will he never be kind to me again? Is his unfailing love gone forever? Have his promises permanently failed? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he slammed the door on his compassion? And I said at that time, this is my fate. The Most High has turned his hand against me. That's how he felt. But then, he says, I recall all you have done, O Lord. I remember your wonderful deeds of long ago. They are continually in my thoughts. I cannot stop thinking of your mighty works. Oh God, your ways are holy. Really, is there any God as mighty as you? You are the God of great wonders. You demonstrated your awesome power among the nations. By your strong arm, you redeemed your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. When the Red Sea saw you, O God, its waters looked and trembled. The sea quaked to its very depths. The clouds poured down rain. The thunder rumbled in the sky. Your arrows of lightning flashed. Your thunder roared from the whirlwind. The lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your road led through the sea. Your pathway through mighty waters. A pathway that no one knew was there. You led your people along that road like a flock of sheep with Moses and Aaron as their shepherd. And he took comfort in the fact that God, the God of the Exodus, was his God. What did he do? When the odds were set, he filled his mind with what he knew was true about God. He didn't let how he felt, he felt these things. Obviously, he felt these things. But he didn't let how he felt, his fear, his worry, his anxiety, he didn't allow it to ultimately eclipse his faith. He recalled God's mighty deeds from long ago. Specifically, he looked back to the Red Sea, to the Exodus, and he reminded himself that the God of the Exodus was his God, same God. And the bottom line, he made the Exodus story a part of his story in his present circumstances. And you see, just like Asaph, to continually see God doing Exodus in your life, you have to continually remind yourself of what you know is true about God. Now, for the Jews, what they knew was true about God was that in the Exodus was a defining moment, forever assuring them of God's love and commitment. For us, the cross stands as our Exodus. The cross forever stands as a monument of God's liberating love and commitment to us. No matter what circumstances we find ourselves in, no matter how we feel about those circumstances, no matter how many question marks flood our minds, no matter if God delivers us the way that we think he should or not, the cross forever reminds us that God is with us and will never forsake us, that God has fought and won the battle, but he continues to fight for us no matter what. The cross is God's commitment to you that he does not save you to abandon you. And that is good news, period. Father God, thank you for your word. Thank you for how in this ancient story, it's not just history. It is that. It's a historical event. It is a real event. But you bring the Exodus story forward through the gospel of Jesus into our lives, those of us that have trusted him as our Savior and follow him as our Lord. You've brought the Exodus forward into our lives so that we can experience the reality every single day when we face difficult times, hard times. We can experience the reality that you always put us where you want us. And God, we can know that that the times when we have to wait, when things are beyond our control, we can know that in that place of waiting that's where we're going to see you working. And then, God, what a great comfort it is to know that in the gospel and in the cross, we can know that we know that we know that you have not saved us to then later abandon us. And so, God, as we go forth into our work weeks and neighborhoods and school, I pray that this week those truths would so grip our hearts that we can put Jesus on display each and every day. For it's in His name I pray. Amen.